Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast. This week we thought we would weigh in on some important matters like should people have pets? But that's for later. First we're going to talk about women in the church because...
That was really insensitive the way you kind of linked in a strange way the having pets and women in church.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty sexist. Clever.
Yeah, right.
I thought, what better way to wake people up on a Monday morning than to join those two things together? So I was really delighted to wake up this morning and find that I had been linked in the middle of an article on Christianity Today, the website, about whether or not women should receive theological education. And I think it would be
really
good just to broaden it out and say, should women be educated at all?
No, but are people really, do people really think that women shouldn't receive theological education?
I'm going to go ahead and say that there must be some people out there, otherwise the article would not exist. Right. It's not really in our sphere.
Okay.
We are not running into a lot of people who are saying, don't educate the women. But
I was raised in Episcopalian. You were raised in Episcopalian or in an
Anglican
context.
And in that realm, the rule is don't educate the men.
Right. So
should
it's hard
man
to
speak in church.
Imagine
that's
there would
a big
be...
no. The men should not speak in church.
Okay, so I guess my question is: is it more of it's not a big deal whether women are educated or not theologically? We shouldn't emphasize it. Or is it even conscious? It's just, it doesn't matter because men are the ones who are going to be pastors, so we shouldn't.
I think, well, the article was really interesting, which you should definitely read sometime. In some theological schools, very conservative ones, some men won't take classes if the professor is a woman. So they can't have women professors. Like, I'm assuming for like Greek or church history or
something.
I see. I feel like that's too big a topic for us right now.
Wow. Yeah.
But you should read the article.
I will.
The question, let's narrow this. Let's just de-escalate here. The question is, should women receive theological... Here's a better question. What happens when you don't theologically educate the women? I was going to say the children. That's even worse.
Well, they're connected. If you don't theologically educate the women...
You can't educate.
You're not theologically educating the children.
Which means you're not educating the next generation of men, and that's terrible. I hear the men of the church weighed in on this important topic. And
yes,
we are
in men's Bible study. We have about anywhere from 15 to some odd people, men gathering every morning for Bible study on Friday, right? Not every morning, every Friday morning at 6:30 a.m. And we're in 1 Timothy, and...
That sounds fun.
Right. Well, we're in 1 Timothy chapter 2, and we've been talking about what women should wear, and what role they should have in the church.
Oh, man. What should women wear in church, Matt? Why don't you enlighten us on that?
Well, Paul says that they should, they should dress themselves modestly. And in a way that draws attention to their godliness rather than their wealth.
Did you drop a list then?
Right. No, but we did talk about.
Did you do a dress code for?
Well, we recognize that it's the male's responsibility in a family, or the man's, either the husband or the father, to make sure that his wife isn't unduly causing.
I feel like you're choking on your own words.
Other men to lust after her. So if your wife is going to church wearing yoga pants, you might say, sweetheart, boy, you look really beautiful. But I think you might look too alluring and cause men to be distracted from Jesus. And I told the story.
And then you get poked in the eye. And so no man says that because men are not allowed to speak in their marriages.
Right.
Or in church.
Well, we did talk about two aspects, and this is from a man's observance of women, not necessarily from, I don't know how women think about it, but we observe that women sometimes do dress for other women, And I think that text in 1 Timothy chapter 2 addresses that, because it's not just dealing with modesty of dress, but also ostentatiousness. And the wealthy women of the era would you know, put plates in not kitchen plates, but plaited hair.
You mean braided?
Plaited and
do you know what adorn that is?
Themselves. Yeah, well, I've seen the pictures of it in like. Yeah, I've seen. So, and adorn themselves in ways that signal their status and their social position.
I would never do that.
And use that as a kind of hammer against the poorer women and the slaves.
Yeah.
In the congregation. And so
I just want you to know that I personally would never do that.
And so I've noted, but I do notice that, but you've told me that before, that women don't always dress for men, that often they dress for other women. And so in that respect, I thought that our discussion was helpful for men to see or to think through that it's not always about their own, it's not always about women trying to attract men. But we also said that sometimes women are blind to, because they're not men, they're blind to what men, a man's eye is drawn to.
That's true. And that's why they should not receive a theological education.
Well, that comes up later. So, but then the other side of it is that sometimes women do, okay, again, I'm talking as a man, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but women do, I think, appreciate the attention of the male eye when they're, and they're not unconscious of it. So while they don't always know what draws the eye, when they catch on something that does, I think they appreciate that and like that. And so it's especially something to be wary of with teenage daughters, who, when they find they've worn something that draws the attention of men that normally don't pay attention to her, or boys that don't pay attention to her, I think that becomes like a thing. I've got to wear more things like this. I've got to, where can I find yoga pants with words in the rear end?
Well, I don't know. It hasn't happened to our oldest child right. yet, but.
And we talked, one of the guys said that his wife or his, I can't remember who it was, but she didn't think that yoga pants were immodest because they covered you all the way to your ankle. Yeah, like a plastered on bodysuit. Yes, you're covered, but.
Hey, you got to take what you can get.
Right.
You know, right. You don't need to be picky.
Right. So then with the discussion, then of course went on to the next part, and I think it's verses 11 and 12, where Paul then goes on to say that women should then learn in quietness and all submissiveness, and that he doesn't permit a woman to teach or hold authority
over a man.
Over a man, yes. So, and there was great
rejoicing. Oh, I'm glad I can't go to that group.
Well, we do go through the Bible, you know, verse by verse,
so that's really good. Okay, so, but the great rejoicing is over the word submissiveness, that the wife should learn right. submissiveness, but was anybody surprised that women should learn anything?
Not at first, but then I went back and we looked at the context, the historical context, and you know, in Ephesus, there was one of the reasons Paul's writing that letter to Timothy is to get him to tell the false teachers in the community to be quiet and get out. Mm-hmm. And Timothy's kind of timid, so he hasn't done that quite well. So one of the false teaching seems to be, the letter's not absolutely clear, but it seems to be some kind of Jewish mysticism. And they're within first century Jewish circles, women were considered unworthy to learn anything. And so they were, you know, the synagogues always separated the men from the women. If the women could go to a synagogue, but it wasn't important for her to learn or to know things. You remember the parable, or not the parable, when Jesus went to Mary and Martha's house.
Yeah.
It was socially inappropriate, to say the least, for Mary to sit there and listen to Jesus teach when Martha was doing the kitchen work. And
well,
and
not that when Martha was doing the kitchen work, it's just that she was there at all.
Right, both, yeah, right, right.
Even if Martha hadn't
been. But Martha's complaint was, I'm doing all the work and she's...
Yeah, she's but...
In. But she shouldn't have been there because she...
By culturally, she shouldn't
culturally, she shouldn't have been there. And Jesus says, nope, she's...
She should be here.
She should be here. The thrust of the conversation was all about that cultural thread in Judaism, which does, at that time anyway, tend to say that a woman's learning is simply, it doesn't matter. And what matters is the father. Right. Right. And they can't do much with it anyway, because, you know, a woman's not reliable. So you can't have a woman speak in court. What worth is the witness of a woman anyway? Remember, that's why the disciples didn't believe the women when they came back from the tomb, because, well, you're women. You're probably just...
It's not good economics.
Right.
It's not good economics to waste time.
Right. So when Paul says a woman should learn, that was revolutionary. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other side, and we don't have time to get to this today, but there seems to have been a first century, something equivalent to a feminist movement that was made perhaps in response to this Jewish false teaching that had wormed its way into the church.
Churches.
Where women were taking on the authority in the role of men.
And throwing off their head covers.
Well, that was in Corinth, but some kinds of things like this might have been going on in Ephesus as well. Throwing off their signs of submission to their husbands and their fathers, and trying to set themselves up as teachers possibly or elders in the community. And so that's also something that Paul seems to be saying, no, you need to submit yourself to the authorities that God has established, your husband, and the church, the pastor, who the assumption of that text seems to be is going to be a man, or men, the elders. So,
what are you, Presbyterian? Sorry.
No, there was no threefold ministry in the first century. There's a twofold, deacons and overseers/elders. So anyway, that was. But we had a great time talking about how, what's the limit?
What's the limit?
What line should we draw toward which women should not cross? Or across which women should not go. We also, so, but it's interesting too, the other thing that's interesting about the text is this the assumption of the spiritual equality of women. Why wouldn't you want a woman to learn? Well, that's if you don't consider her your equal in the spiritual terms. But the gospel is that we are justified by faith, and that women and men together have access to that. That's why women are baptized as men are, right, in the new covenant, right, and women had no access to the circumcision, obviously, in the old, right, in the old covenant, but men did, and so in the New Testament, there's this baptism which signals this. The reality is that it's always been there, that women are ontologically equal with men. There's no difference in our humanity.
Are you sure? Just say that again.
And so, therefore, they ought to be taught and learned just like a man. And in particular, since their particular role is to raise children, I don't know that many men are seen there catechizing their children. They should. We don't.
Why wouldn't you want the women to be top-notch theologians? Exactly. If you're educating the next generation of Christians.
Exactly.
But children's ministry is back... you know, shoved in the back cupboard too in many churches.
Right.
And is relegated to be good, be nice.
Right.
And the women should worry about being good women, and the children should be good children. Mm-hmm. And the men go hunting.
Right, right.
And so I think there exists in sort of the Christian landscape, there's two extremes. The one extreme, on maybe we might call it the right, is the women aren't human. You know, there's the male pastor up at front, and he's preaching, and the women get taught about modest dress and child rearing and being a good wife. And they start... And there's this kind
of conscious playing out of a role.
Yeah. The gender roles are, I would always say, very culturally bound on that end. That maybe, that kind of Christian expression makes me so antsy and uncomfortable, because it isn't biblical per se. It's just, it's like 1950s.
Right.
Imported right up to today. It doesn't account for the fact that women are educated in the secular sphere. All women go to high school. Most women go to college that you would end up seeing in a church. Many. Maybe not all. Most women have to work. That expression doesn't account for the fact that economically, all women in today's world have to work. And if a woman stays home with her children, she's making a
huge sacrifice.
A huge culturally unvalued choice, I would say. So she, you know, she's doing something kind of rebellious if she doesn't go to work culturally. Okay, but that's on the right. Right, and women are certainly not educated theologically. And guess what happens when you do that? They run out and they go buy Beth Moore Bible studies, and they go listen to Jen Hatmaker, and they go to these big conferences.
Well, right,
because they're starving to death.
And these people are specifically targeting them. I mean, they're targeting a female audience that
they know is hungry.
They know is hungry, and they may, I mean, the women themselves who are leading these things may not know, but Satan certainly knows that women have not been, are not largely theologically educated.
Right. And so it's like a great opportunity for evil to, or heterodoxy to proliferate.
Well, and this is not new. This is first century. This is why Paul was warning.
He's saying, educate your women. Okay, but that's the right. On the left, you have a similarly extreme situation, which I think is more our comfort level. This is what we've come out of. And that is that men are not human. I mean, I think this is one reason why I prefer to write about men than women, because I think culturally, the humanity of men is not affirmed in a cultural sense. You have the church is really power dominated by women in the pulpit, in the altar guild, in all the functions, and men are allowed to come.
Are shamed for being men.
If they be quiet, right? And if they sort of take on more feminine characteristics and are think of themselves as feminists, then they can function in this enlightened sphere. And what that does is it completely drives men out of the church.
Oh, absolutely.
And you end up with sort of a liberal version of Ethel Rutherford.
I remember someone telling me that at our seminary we went to, the person who was teaching how to pray the Eucharistic prayer, the communion prayer, told Matt Kessler, who's...
That's right.
Right, that he needed to learn how to pray from his womb.
I don't have a womb
to pray from.
Are you
from.
Sure, man? You need to find it.
Right.
You need to pray from it.
But that strain of turned the men into women was really strong in our seminary, and so you couldn't have male pronouns, and I mean that was really offensive.
You had to say God over and over again. You couldn't talk about God as if he was a human.
Not just in the new liturgies they were experimenting with at the time, enriching our worship, or, as we say, emasculating our worship.
Impoverishing our worship,
whatever it was. But they would... those, of course, eliminated all of the male pronouns from the liturgy. But even in preaching and talking and speaking, professors would routinely, when referring to God, edit out any male pronoun.
Yeah.
Or female. Well, which female was more allowable, actually.
You could refer to God as she. The Holy Spirit is she. It
produced these horrible circumlocutions. I wonder what God and God's self would think about God's, I mean,
God's dream into the world.
Right? It's just horrible. And it sounds so stupid and I'm sorry.
I couldn't go to chapel by the end because I couldn't bear it.
And pretentious. I mean, they were, that was before the age where virtue signaling became a thing.
It was early virtue signaling. Okay, so for me, I my hobby horse, because that's what I, you know, that I had to, I sat under women in seminary who just made my, I didn't enjoy it. And I didn't enjoy the heresy. I didn't enjoy the mashing of men into the ground. I don't think the world is interesting if you bind and gag all the men and disallow them from being who they are, you know, and if you create a new cultural expression for them. I mean, you on the right, you have this cultural expression for women that is really, I'd say, outdated, and it doesn't deal with the reality that we have. And on the left, you have this new cultural expression for men that is unbiblical, I would say. I'd say both are probably unbiblical.
The thing is, and I think egalitarianism within the Christian, I mean, I don't want to bash.
I think those two paradigms, egalitarianism and complementarianism.
We should explain this for people who don't know what those are.
Failing.
Egalitarianism.
Both of them are failing.
Christian egalitarians believe that the biblical instructions for women to be submissive within the household and that men should be the leaders in the church are culturally bound and ought not to necessarily rule the way that we order our church lives and our marriages today. And so they argue for what's called egalitarianism, where women and men have equal roles in the family and equal roles in the church, including access to the pastorate. The complementarian position says, no, these are not culturally bound commands. They're quite clear. And there's no, and in fact, often Paul appeals to the created order in establishing the subordination or subordination, the submissiveness of women within both contexts. So we can't say they're merely cultural appendages. And so they need to be carried forward into every era, not just the first century. How we do that is, even within complementarian circles, a matter of debate, but that's...
I would just say, though, that a lot of the complementarian stuff that I've read, it falls sort of easily into this... again, I'm going to just repeat myself, this sort of older and not where we really are... cultural expression of, say, femininity and masculinity.
Right. I mean, the weakness of the complementarian position is it does sometimes become subject to our own cultural manifestation of traditional manifestation of role, and that's not necessarily biblical. It's often not. I mean, the John Wayne June Cleaver dichotomy that's not biblical. That's cultural. And we've kind of shellacked that over the Bible.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, we're saying this because you and I think are both, we'd consider ourselves complementarian. We're not egalitarian in our
theology.
View.
Although, I don't like the way that it's expressed, the complementarian. I don't like the way that it's, I would say in all our marriage counseling, I've seen many, many women trying to do acrobatics to fit themselves into what they think women ought to be like and men ought to be like. You know, we've spent a lot of time actually in marriage counseling trying to help people treat each other as human beings, which is a more tending towards the more egalitarian, you know, like this person is a person. So on the one hand, to the man, don't mash her into the ground and cause her not never to speak and never to learn. And on the other hand, to the woman, don't deny the personhood of your husband, which is very easy for women to do.
Right. Well, one person there on Friday said that he understood the biblical instructions for him to be the leader of the home, spiritual leader of the home, in such a way that he had to always be right about a theological argument. He had to know everything and correct his wife. And he'd never considered the reality of her being there to advise, counsel, and even
correct
him as the head. I mean, that's, when you look at the created order, Eve was to be Adam's helper in governing. Mm-hmm. So if he didn't listen to Eve, he would be stupid.
And he was stupid.
He was stupid. So men I mean, so in the perfect world.
She was so stupid. Yeah.
Right. Well, and so now, of course, why would, if that's your role to help me lead the family, even though I'm supposed to be a leader, and I believe that you know the Bible well, and you know Jesus, I should have an open ear to what you say, because God has given you to me.
We have all the children are running and shouting.
Because God has given you to me to help in this thing. And if I don't listen to you, I'm just... When your mother says be quiet, you be quiet. Sorry.
Be quiet, children. Mommy and Daddy are podcasting. And now the dogs have awoken. This must be Satan attacking us. Right.
So anyway.
Well, I can't remember where we were. There were so many children there.
So, but he said he found it very helpful in marriage counseling. When we said, oh no, she, have you ever, I asked him, has there ever been a time when you've said to her, you know, you're right about this? And he couldn't think of a time. They've been dating for a year and a half. This is during marriage counseling. You remember this?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and so he said that was remarkable. That changed his whole view about how to lead.
That's so upsetting.
But I think that's like on the conservative side. That's how it usually plays out.
You have to be right.
I'm the Bible teacher. You're the student.
Yeah.
You be quiet.
And the problem with that is that I'm the Bible teacher. I don't actually have time to study the Bible, mm-hmm. So I'm going to get to it every now and then. And you wait, and then when I happen to remember to read my Bible and I mention something to you, then we're all good. And meanwhile, she's starving to death, and she goes and gets online
and finds
and
Jen
buys
Hatmaker.
Jen Hatmaker.
Right, exactly.
And that's so foolish. I mean, that's utter foolishness.
Right.
So I would say, on the question of whether women should go to seminary, okay, we're not here to argue about women's ordination. But I think that women should be theologically educated.
Absolutely.
And some
get
women
that woman
should...
a master's degree in theology and it from a
doctorate.
good seminary, right?
And you know what? If she's good at teaching church history, then she should.
Right.
Well, let's not talk about that.
Well, we could, because the context for Paul's instruction for women not to have teaching authority over a man is the context of church worship and preaching and teaching in the church, but. Teaching a church history course is hardly the same thing. It's an educational context, not a spiritual authority context.
Right. And the question of women's participation in life overall, women have to work. You know, they have to be out in the world. They have to be educated in the secular sphere in order. There's no room in our world for women not to be able to read.
Right.
They should break their teeth on the Bible. If you expect your sons to do that, your daughters should do that too.
They should be learning. Look, your kids should be. You are not gonna. If you're working, like most men do, you should expect your wife to know enough of the Bible to instruct your children. And you should
and
help
be,
her, and to be sound in doing so. right. And you should want her to have in-depth knowledge and ability to communicate what she knows. Even John MacArthur, who's a hardcore complementarian, said that your wife should learn and know the Bible because she's the one who's going to shape the men who take the pulpits in the future.
Yeah.
And if you have any care and concern about the church, you want your wife to know the scriptures.
I'm shaking my head.
Right.
in wonderment. I lost my train of thought because this dog, there was an absolute fight. Our three little girls were about to commit violence upon each other's persons. and I just told them to go away, and the dog is now wishing that he could have all my attention, so I've completely lost what I was going to say, which I feel like it was really interesting. I feel like it was going to be fascinating, but it's completely gone. You said John MacArthur, and it just, everything leapt out of my brain.
We were talking about the need to, you know, if you're going to raise children, you need to know enough to raise them biblically.
Yeah. Okay, this is what I... So what happens in a church when you relegate, say, the women to running the kitchen, doing the dinners, keeping the cupboards clean, and running the children's ministry?
With no say or no input with regard to any other, like, ministries, is that...
Yeah, I mean, what... So, one of the interesting things that I talk about Good Shepherd a lot, but it's interesting to me because, you know, 90% of the women at Good Shepherd work for money. If they're not working for money, they're homeschooling their children, which is a hugely vast task, and certainly one that requires theological acumen and biblical knowledge. Also manage to keep the cupboards clean and do them.
Right, right.
They do a huge amount of bulk work in the, physical work in the church.
Right.
But they do participate in the theological life of the church.
Yeah.
You know, there's not this, like...
Well, so women can question me.
Yeah.
And they can say, I'm not sure you got that text right, or can you explain why... You think it means this, but I don't see it meaning this, or they can say to they take just as great a part in classes and Bible studies as anyone else does, and so there's no women not participating in the theological part
right.
of our church, and
the teaching is for them.
Yeah,
you know, the sermon on Sunday is for women and also children who stay, and men, and everybody has to attend,
right?
And is responsible to know what's going on. And there's not a division of, I wonder if the women will get it, or maybe I should preach about something else because this text isn't relevant to them, and so I'm not going to bother, or, I think that sometimes those choices must be made by pastors. So this is where I was finally going in that huge interruption. I think women should be educated theologically. I guess that was never a question for me.
Mm-hmm.
In my mind, the thing that's been irritating me as I've watched, you know, the last couple of years in Christian culture and internet arguing is the terrible way that men have been educated. I think seminary education overall, and that's because we are coming out of a really bad one, is pretty lame, and not enough men know how to preach.
Right.
So if you've got a guy up in the pulpit Sunday after Sunday who thinks his job is to
cast a vision
or make sure everybody's behaving properly, or spending a lot of time on gender roles, or just talking about his own personal, you know, thing that he's most interested in week after week after week, you're going to have women who want to go to seminary because their preacher is
starving them.
So it's, you know, I would think to myself, of course women should go to seminary. That was never a question in my mind. The question is, shouldn't the men go more and longer and better? And shouldn't they be held to quite a high standard so that they're not just ruining them? I mean, in other words, I think that the dearth and failure of preaching and theological education in America for men bears some responsibility for the rise of Jen Hatmaker,
mm-hmm.
In our, mm-hmm. and, you know, the downfall of Beth Moore.
Right.
You know,
and I think the real culprit, I think you're right here, is the lack of expositional preaching.
Yeah.
Because in expositional preaching is going through the scriptures and taking a book, unpacking it verse by verse or whatever over the course of time. And so when that doesn't happen, you preach topically, you preach to and to entertain, you preach to a felt need, you vision cast for your church, whatever. And seminaries regularly teach those other kinds of preaching.
Yeah.
And that ends up starving a congregation,
right,
or placing heavy burdens on their backs,
right,
to do the life tips that the preacher is giving them.
Which in turn drives them to the internet.
Right. But I mean, our own theological seminary, VTS, was, you know, the biblical component was rather sparse. The connection between what we were learning in New Testament, Old Testament studies, and our preaching class was rarely closely made. I mean, some of the homiletics professors were okay, but we had one good one. But it was so sparse, and in the original languages, we were required to take one semester of original languages, which was pathetic. Now compare that to a good seminary like Westminster Theological Seminary,
yeah,
where it's 4 years, not
yeah,
3 years. And these guys are, all the classes are integrated. The theology, the Bible, the preaching, it's all part of integrated whole. And no, they are learning the languages, the original languages. They are not just taking a semester. They're learning those languages and incorporating that, what they learn, into their preaching and teaching. So it's a great, that's the kind of seminary that we need for most.
Yeah. I mean, that's a place of hope.
Yeah.
But I do think that occasionally women should go there as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know?
I don't even know if women are...
I don't know if they're allowed.
I don't know. But women...
But I think there should be a track for women to go there.
So do you agree with this? Here's one of the things that we were talking about in men's Bible study, was that women do tend to lack discernment in a way that men don't. Women are more easily led astray, and that's why the serpent went to Eve and deceived her. And Adam was not deceived, we're told there in that section, in First Timothy chapter 2.
He just failed to act, so what's the point of not being deceived?
His sin was worse because he wasn't deceived.
He just went with it.
Right. But she was deceived, and had he been playing his role correctly, he would have been to bolster her discernment.
Yeah.
Because
the idea is that
women are more prone to emotional appeals,
yeah,
more prone to a charismatic speaker, whereas men, I think, I'm being terribly sexist and stereotypical here, but are prone to see through the BS in an argument
Although I think culturally, as men have been disallowed to be men,
right, they become more feminized,
they lose that ability. No, I think that's probably true. I think it's interesting and worthy of note that prominent women have become heterodox and pulled vast sections of women along with them. That's true. I mean, but at the same time, you have people like Stephen Furtick and Joel Osteen, you know. Well, their congregations are full of women.
Right, but that goes back to what we were talking about a minute ago, where we have a group of people who are theologically inept themselves, or
right,
who have latched onto a theology or a philosophy of the Christian ministry that is false.
Yeah,
and that's why that explains Furtick, and that explains you know, most of those guys who are off the rails.
I agree. I think women. This is why, because if women, you know, on the one hand are starving and are, you know, maybe more driven in general by emotionalism, then you have a perfect situation,
right,
for heresy.
Right.
I'm trying to think, you know, outside of myself. I'm not very emotional myself.
Then you're open
myself
to the false teachers who go door to door deceiving weak-willed women.
There you are. I'm not very emotional, so
mm-hmm.
I don't understand the appeal. Like, I you know, when I've watched clips of Beth Moore, I don't think, I'd rather go read something else. So I'm not a good judge of what, mm-hmm. how deceived other women. I actually think, I'm going to say this in all humility, that I have a better gift of discernment than some people.
Yeah.
And other women should listen to me because I'm good at seeing through garbage.
You are. That's one of the things I want to compliment you
and
about.
And I think women, I think women at Good Shepherd listen to me. Mm-hmm. That often I have people coming to me saying, should I read this book? Or I heard this said, and I'll say, that's really bad. Don't do that. And the women at Good Shepherd, that's one of the parts of the ministry that I have there. And that is probably because I did make it through seminary, which was a place ripe with heresy.
Yeah.
And I had to learn to judge truth from error.
Right.
So if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't have this.
Yeah. The ear tuned to falsehood.
Yeah. I have an antenna out. You want to say something stupid to me and I will be able to detect it because there's so much out there.
Well, it's so easy now too, because, a lot of, this is,
we're not going to have time to talk about why you should have pets.
I know. But what's happening in evangelicalism now is just a larger version of what happened in the Episcopal Church.
Yeah.
And all the language that we were used to in 2002 and 2003 in the Episcopal Church is now broadened out.
Right.
And it's pervasive. So we hear that kind of talk. We know exactly immediately
where it's going.
Well, let's have a conversation and dialogue. And it's all about gathering around the table together and all that stuff that evangelicals are now spouting. Is just cover for heresy and the attempt to import sexual deviancy into the church. So
it's really tragic.
Right.
Anyway, I guess we'll leave it right there.
Yeah.
And we'll pick up next week with another topic, why should children have pets? But probably we won't because we'll forget that. And
we should write down during the week things to talk about.
Yeah, because...
And if our listener wants to have us say anything...
Yeah, they should.
Or he should, or he should.
These should please write in because we struggle every week to know what to talk about. Also, I did want to just apologize for the terrible sound quality, the arguing children, the dog, the ruffling of sound in this
studio.
This studio. Next week, maybe we'll try to beat back some of that better. But thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week.